Anyhow, all right, Scheme of Redemption. So to start off, I will not be here 2 Wednesdays from now, June the 15th. So if someone would like to fill in, that would be great. Topic of your choice, just have at it. So if you could let me know, or Doug or Mike or somebody, I don't know, you know, grab one of the other leaders here and let them know, they can get it back to me. But if you just want to tell me, that's fine too. But I do need to fill in for that Wednesday. So if someone here is willing, that would be awesome. All right, so the goals of our study is to learn how God moved from man's problem of sin to his solution of Jesus on the cross. And that's really the crux of what this whole thing is about. It's called the scheme of redemption. You know, what are we being redeemed from? Well, you know, when it was in the beginning, when we were first created, when we're first born, we're simply born into a relationship with God. We are a creation of his. And the miracle of life is continued to be carried out in very real ways every day. You know, as life comes into the world, a new creation is made. And it is, you cannot deny that it is something from God. The very design of his creation and the way he has caused things to work. When we can read in Jeremiah how God spoke to Jeremiah and said, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you." And so we cannot deny the reality that we are all created by God. And so we are born into a relationship with him and into it with a connection with him. However, at some point in each of our lives, we fall away by our sin, by our disobedience of his will, by our leaving his path and going our own way. We walk away from God. It's not that he walks away from us or that he has left us. It is we who have left him. And so he has bought us back. I read a story, like a kid story one time, kind of how to explain redemption to children. And it talked about how a little boy had a boat. And he had a little toy boat, and he was out playing in the rain gutters one day along the street. You know, it was raining, so he had his boat going down there. And as it was floating down the side of the road, it went off into one of the drains. And he lost his boat. And so somebody ended up finding it later on, apparently, and they put it up for sale in just a little store. And the boy was walking by one day, and he saw his boat in the window of the store. And he went in and bought his boat back. You know, his boat got away from him, but he found it, and he bought it back. And that's precisely what God has done with us. We got away from him. By our own actions, we got away from him. And he, like that shepherd that Jesus talked about that left the 99 sheep behind to go find the one, he found us. And he brought us back. And he brought us back through his son on the cross. Also, to understand how everything in the scripture relates to and points to Jesus and the cross. I've talked a lot about how everything in scripture, it all points to the cross. If it has nothing to do with the cross or any kind of relation to the reasoning of the cross, it's simply not there. There are a lot of things that could have been written in that book. I mean, a lot of things. A lot of things that God did, that his people did, that Jesus did, that his prophets did, his disciples did. You go down the whole gamut. There is we could fill the Library of Congress 1,000 times over, if not more, with all the things that could possibly be recorded of the actions of God and his people. But yet, it is all summarized here in this book. And everything in here all relates to the redeeming of mankind and restoring us back to God and putting us back in his family. That's what it's all about. And so everything in there relates to and points to Jesus and the cross in some way or fashion. Also, one of the little side goals is to learn more about God. You know, in every story, there's something to draw out of there about the nature of God, who he is, what he's like, what he doesn't like, the things that make him tick, the things that make him happy, you know. In our effort to be a child of God and to be like our Father, we need to take note of those things and see, okay, well, what is it in this story that I can learn about my Father to help me change my life, to mold myself more after him, to be more like him? And so that's kind of a side goal that we have there. And finally, to get a better understanding of how we got here tonight on the orange carpet. We're here for a reason. You know, we're not just a bunch of crazy nuts that thought it'd just come to be fun to come together and sing some weird songs about let the lower lights be burning and all this kind of stuff and make some cool social club out of it. You know, we're here for a reason. And so the idea of redemption and being made to, restored to the family of God is the reason we're here. And so these are the goals of our study. All right, some of the main concepts. We've talked about the scheme of redemption as the plan of God established before creation to redeem mankind from sin. To view the Bible basically as a novel. I've changed my wording up there some because I like this idea of a novel. You know, I enjoy reading. Charlie and Gail have given me some great books on Florida history. If you haven't read some of them, let's see, Canaveral Light was one, A Time Remembered, and Bright Feather. Those are three great books. I recommend them. But, you know, if they had given me that book and I picked it up and started in chapter 30, I would have no idea what was going on. I mean, there would be a lot of stuff that I've missed. All the character development, all the stuff that led up to whatever is taking place in chapter 30. I may have missed the whole plot in itself or in and of itself. You know, I may have moved past the climax of the story. I mean, you miss so much by just kind of picking up and jumping around here and there. So the proper way to read a novel is start in chapter 1 and work your way through. And if we don't do that, this thing right here just won't make a lot of sense. And that's some of the struggles that we see with people in the world today. They don't understand this story because they read a certain verse, they read a certain chapter, say, man, this thing is stupid. It doesn't make any sense. No, thank you. And so it's our job to be familiar with the story. You know, and we're basically to be book report people. You know, Charlie and Gail said, man, you'd love this book. It involves this and this and this. It's a really good story. Well, it piques my interest. But, you know, they can't really sell me on how great the story might be if they themselves haven't read it and they themselves don't know what it's all about. And so if we're going to be out there giving the book report of the gospel, as it were, we have to be familiar with the story. We've got to be ready to give that defense. When people come and charge us with how stupid this book is and all the insane stories in there, we got to be ready and able to give a defense that says, maybe not. Hear me out. Perhaps I can help make sense of it. All right? So it's good for us to understand that this book is not just some crazy book with a bunch of different stories all stuck together. It's a novel. Okay, and so instead of seeing it as 66 books all compiled into one book, let's see it as one book with 66 different chapters. Also in our Bibles, we have that division between Malachi and Matthew, that division we know as the Old Testament and the New Testament. But I want to suggest to us that the real division of the Bible takes place at Genesis chapter 3 and verse 6, because it's there that sin enters the world. Prior to Genesis 3 and verse 6, we had this very heaven-like place. Okay, I've said it here many times that it was almost heaven materialized in a very real sense. That there are things that plague our lives today and just make life here on earth to be absolutely miserable that did not exist in the world of Genesis chapter 1 and 2. And so that's where the real true division takes place. So Genesis 1 and 2 we've defined as God in perfection, man in innocence. Genesis chapter 3 chapters 3 through 12 we've defined as the background of redemption. It's there we really start to see the framework of why the cross. You know, why did Jesus have to go? Well, that question starts to be answered in this section here. I mean, we see tragedy after tragedy after tragedy going on. And it's basically God screaming out to us in 10 chapters saying, I have got to get to the cross. And there, starting in Genesis chapter 12, we start to see the wheels of redemption moving. That's when they really start to grab traction, and we start to see God taking action through Abraham, through Isaac, through Jacob, and even through Joseph. And that's kind of where we are right now. All right, so in the story of Abraham, in this time of the patriarchs, we see three main promises that will flow through the whole patriarchal period. And when we talk about the patriarchal period, we're talking about the period of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Basically, the period from Abraham really leading up to Moses. We could probably include the time period from the beginning to Moses if we just want to call that whole period the patriarchal period. But really it starts there at Abraham, and it moves all the way up until Moses when we enter the Mosaical age of the Bible. And so three main promises that God made to Abraham was, one, he would make a great nation from him and from his descendants. Two, that his descendants would receive the land of Canaan as an inheritance. And three, through Abraham, all the families or nations of the earth would be blessed, depending on which version you're reading from. That third promise I've said in here is still alive and well this very second. I mean, down to this very moment, you and I right now are beneficiaries of that promise, because it's through Abraham, through his seed, came Jesus Christ. And we are now blessed supremely through the seed of Abraham in Jesus Christ. So even to this very moment, until Jesus returns, that promise will continue to be fulfilled to Abraham and also to Isaac and Jacob, as we will see as we go through. All right, so we've talked about how God promised Abraham an heir and a child, and Isaac was born. We then see that God tells Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. And by this time, Abraham's faith has really grown. You know, as Abraham got to this point, a lot of stuff had taken place. We see two different instances where he was pretty scared of going into a new city. And when they see my wife, Sarah, how beautiful she is, they'll kill me so they can take her. And so he comes up with this idea of, she's my sister. And so he does it with the Pharaoh in Egypt, and he also does it with Abimelech, who is a king of Gerar, I think. And so we see Abraham do this twice, and both times God comes to Abimelech and the Pharaoh and says, you best turn her loose right now or else. And they come to Moses saying, dude, what is your problem, man? Why are you lying to us like this? You're going to get us killed and ruin our families. Don't stop that. And so Abraham starts to learn, okay, man, God really is with me. And then we see the whole Ishmael thing take place. You know, God says, look, through your descendants, all this stuff's going to happen. Well, Abraham didn't have a child at that time. And so 10 years had gone by and nothing had happened with him and Sarah. They still hadn't had a child. And so Abraham says, well, maybe there's a different route about this. And so Sarah gives him Hagar. And with Hagar, Ishmael is born. And Abraham says, okay, well, this must be the one. God says, no, that's not my plan. That may be your plan, but that's not my plan. Stop trying to force my hand on things, you know. And we can understand that. So often in our own life, we see how, things that we're facing and that we're up against, sometimes it's just hard to sit back and wait upon the Lord and see what he does. You know, so we start trying to, well, maybe God just wants me to do this because, I mean, this is what I really want. So let me just try to make it happen. And next thing you know, we end up in a bigger mess than what we were in to begin with. So sometimes we need to learn just to sit back and wait upon the Lord. And that's not an easy thing to do. It wasn't easy for Abraham. And there's plenty of other stories in the scriptures where it just was not easy for those people to do that. It's not easy. But we need to have these stories hammered on us time and time and time and time again, just browbeat them into us to help us see and know that we can put our full and total faith and trust in God. And he will handle our situations. He will take care of us. But at this sacrifice here, we see that Abraham's faith had really matured. You know, God comes to him and says, hey, I want you to go to some mountain I'm going to tell you, and I want you to sacrifice your only son. Abraham says, okay, let's go. And they take off. And we see that, and we say, man, that is a wild story. What is this all about? How is God going to ask somebody to kill their child for him? That doesn't make sense. That's the most stupidest thing. Is that the most stupidest? Is that right, Mangus? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. What kind of God is this? And so, you know, we read these things, and people who aren't familiar with the scriptures read that and say, no, thank you. I'm not serving a crazy nut of a God like that. But there's an answer to that. And when we read the story, we see that God stopped the hand of Abraham. But the very real truth is, is that it was centuries later, thousands of years later, that God put his own son upon the altar. But he didn't stop the hands. We see Abraham and Isaac heading to the mountain, and Isaac says, "Hey, Dad, I see the fire and the wood, but hey, where's the lamb for the offering?" And Abraham simply says, "My son, God will provide himself the lamb for the burnt offering." And you know, we see that played out in the ram that was caught in the thicket, right? But the real truth is that Abraham had no idea how prophetic his words were. Indeed, God did provide the lamb, because it was thousands of years later when they raised the crown of thorns and shoved it down upon his head. Nobody stopped that hand. The lifting of the flogs, the raising of the hammers to drive in those nails, the thrusting of the spear into his side. God did not stop those hands. And so what we see here is this crazy story about God asking a man to sacrifice his son when it's God saying, "I'm going to do that for you one day. And I'm not going to stop the hands." And it's this powerful, powerful story. And when we put that together, wow. All of a sudden, the story of Abraham just overwhelms us. The story of him putting his own son there, that overwhelms us. Because see, that suddenly it becomes personal, doesn't it? Folks, I'd be hard-pressed to kill any of my children and sacrifice any of them. Hard-pressed. Even if God himself came and asked me to do it, I would be hard-pressed. I'm just going to be straight up frank with you. But God himself was not willing to stop himself against his own son. And that's the very real truth of that story.
Isaac's faith is something we overlook.
Sure.
He's a young man, somewhere between 15 and 18 years old.
Yeah.
And he's got a dad who's over 100. So I imagine he could probably whoop him if he had.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, it'd be an interesting thing to. I'd love to know the background of that story. And how that all went down. Had to have, yeah. But folks, this is a big deal. This story of Abraham and Isaac in the altar is monumental. And we have to suck everything we can out of this story to understand exactly what happened at the cross. That's how intense the cross was. That's how intense the cross is. But God put his own son on that altar for you and for me. And folks, that's a game changer. That is a life changer. Big deal. All right, so moving along. I'm going to go ahead and tell you tonight is not going to be anything earth-shattering. I'm kind of hitting the fast-forward button, as it were. We're gonna kind of skip across the life of Isaac and Jacob. And look, they're great stories. I don't want to minimize that. They're really cool stories, crazy stories, if you want to be just flat out honest about it. Some the behaviors and the actions of some of these people are just devious and underhanded. It's like, man, what kind of people are, what is wrong with you people? You know, we read this stuff and how Laban handled Jacob and the whole Rachel and Leah situation. It's just like, my word, what is wrong with these people? Great story. So I highly encourage you to go through and read the stories there. You will not be disappointed. It great, great stories. But tonight we're going to kind of just skip through those and fast forward on. I'm trying to get into Joseph, or to the 12 tribes, or the 12 sons of Jacob, and into the story of Joseph. So we'll see how far we get. All right, so in Genesis chapter 23, Sarah dies. Abraham goes and he purchases a piece of land with a cave on it, and that becomes the tomb that he buries Sarah in. And we also see that he and Isaac and Jacob and Leah and Rebekah, They were all buried there as well. I think Rachel was the only one that wasn't, if I'm not mistaken. So this becomes like the Abraham family burial site. So that's in Genesis 23. Genesis 24, Isaac's now 40 years old, and Abraham sends for a wife for Isaac. And so Rebekah is brought to him to be his wife. In Genesis chapter 26, all right, so I think Abraham has died by this time, if I'm not mistaken. Don't quote me on that, though, and I'm getting myself out of order. But in Genesis 26, verses 3 through 5, we see the staff of redemption being passed from Abraham onto Isaac. And so Abraham kind of ran shop there for many years. Now Isaac is on the scene. He's 40 years old. Abraham's dying or is dead by this time. And so the staff of redemption is passed on to Isaac. And we see the exact things being promised to Isaac that were promised to Abraham. Would someone like to read for me?
I will give all these lands. I will establish the oath which I sworn to your father Abraham. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and will give your descendants all these lands. Give your descendants all these lands. And by your descendants, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my law.
Okay, so see, here we see the same promises being laid out to Isaac. I will give you these lands. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven. You know, that's the same thing he told Abraham. Your descendants are going to be like the stars of heaven, the dust of the earth. I will give your descendants all these lands, talking about there the land of Canaan. And by your descendants, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. The same three promises that were laid out to Abraham are now being passed on and laid out to Isaac. All right, in Genesis chapter 26, verses 6 through 11, we see Isaac pull the exact same, she's my sister bit, with the same guy, Abimelech, that Abraham last did. And so here again, you know, Isaac's kind of following in his daddy's footsteps as it goes. And so he does the same thing with the same guy, Abimelech. And once again, Abimelech, actually this time God didn't come to Abimelech in a dream. Instead, he saw Isaac caressing Rebekah. You know, it could have been that he was just very lovingly caress her. That seemed to be more than just the brother-sister thing. And Abimelech comes to him and says, "No, man, that's your wife. What's up with you and your, what's up with you and your dad? Why do y'all do this to us, you know?" And so Abimelech, once again, takes control of this situation and says, "Hey, nobody mess with this guy." And so Abimelech had learned his lesson through Abraham, and now he's recognizing the situation with Isaac and is saying, "Everybody leave him alone. Stay away from him." But we need to take note of the pattern here because we can't let this go by, but this is kind of one of those little pearls, you know, that's easy to skip over and miss, but there's something to be said there. So back in Genesis chapter 9, you remember Noah came off the ark, and what happened? The very next story we read, Noah got hammered, and something terrible happened between him and his son. Genesis 12, Abraham receives these monumental promises, and then he goes and starts lying about who his wife is. Isaac, Genesis 26, Isaac receives the monumental promises, the same thing that he had promised to Abraham. Goes and lies about who his sister is. So this pattern, folks, you see this pattern? God makes promises, God does something, boom, sin. God says something, God promises something, boom, sin. God is hammering over and over and over, repetition, repetition, repetition. I have got to get to the cross. Sin is still a problem. Even after the great global flood, even after the monumental, mighty faith of Abraham, and now, you know, that faith instilled in Isaac and the same promises reiterated to Isaac, sin is still a problem, still has to be handled. God still has to get to the cross. We see this pattern over and over and over and over throughout this section of the Bible. All right, so now we see we're getting into Isaac having his children. We've got some time to do some reading. Got a lot of reading here. Anybody want to read for me Genesis 25, 21 through 23?
Children struggled together within her. And she said, "If it is so, why then am I this way?" But she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger."
Okay, so keep this passage in your minds here. Kind of tuck it away in how God is specifying how something's going to take place before a birth of these two people or even has even happened yet. Keep that in your mind because we're going to talk about it in just a little bit. All right, so the Lord tells her two nations are in your womb and the two peoples will be separated from your body. And so we eventually see how that plays out. You know, Isaac or from Jacob comes the tribe of Israel. And then from Esau came the Edomites, which would eventually become an enemy for Israel. And they kind of have issues with Edom for centuries to come. I mean, way out into the future, we see Israel and Edom always kind of butting heads there. And eventually in Obadiah, we see that judgment was pronounced against Edom. Edom was Esau. That's the nation of Edom came from Esau, and so we eventually see God pronouncing judgment against Edom or Esau with Obadiah. All right, and so in the rest of Genesis chapter 25, Esau comes in from hunting one day. He's very hungry, and he asks Jacob for a bowl of stew. You know, he just comes in, "Oh, I'm just so starving." It may have been the fact that he was really hungry, all right? Esau was a hunter. Something else that I'm kind of skipping over quickly here, at their birth, it says that Esau was a very hairy man. All right, it said when he was born, he came out with red hair all over him. He was a very, 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 very hairy man. Jacob was not. Okay, Jacob was a very smooth-skinned guy, probably much like me. I'm not a very hairy guy at all. And so that was one of the main differences between those two. So we're also told that Esau was a hunter. And so, you know, we kind of view Esau as one of these, you know, big, tough, burly men that's out in the wilderness, you know, can rough it and tough it with the best of them. But it says Jacob was one who dwelt in tents. It says that Isaac loved Esau because Isaac had a real good taste for game. He liked game, and he liked the savory dishes that Esau could prepare from his game. But then it says that Rebekah, though, loved Jacob. Said that Jacob dwelled in tents, so we kind of see Jacob probably being more the not so much out in the woods and romping through the creeks and mud bogs and all that kind of stuff, hunting animals, but kind of a guy who's hanging more around the house. And so we see Esau and Isaac loving, you know, Isaac has that love for Esau, Rebekah has that love for Jacob. So Jacob here is cooking, Esau comes in. You know, Esau really truly may have been in a bad situation. There's have any of you guys ever been on like the verge of a heat stroke before? Yeah, you ever felt that? It is a terrible feeling. It's happened to me a couple of times, and there's been times where I haven't drank enough water, and this usually happens to me when I start exercising again after having not done so for a long time. My body's just not used to it, and so I jump in there, I go on a run, or I go to the gym for the first day, and all of a sudden, you start getting real lightheaded. You start getting these hot and cold flashes. Start sweating profusely, feeling heavily nauseated. Like you're about to pass out. Very dizzy. It's a terrible, terrible feeling. Horrible feeling. I hate it. It's happened two or three times to me. So it's quite possible that maybe Esau was truly feeling this way. You know, maybe he had been out in the field. It had been hot, and he had been out there roaming around trying to find some game. He very well may have come in and literally felt like he was about to die. Or it could have just been, you know, one of these things, kind of like where kids come in sometimes, right? And, I mean, they just ate 2 hours ago. "Mom, I'm starving. Can I please have a snack?" Right? You know, we see that thing played out. Not that Alicia and I see that ever, you know. But You know, so we don't really know what's going on here, right? But Esau comes in, he's like, oh, I'm just starved to death. Well, let me have some of that stew there. And so Jacob gives it to him, but he says, I'll tell you what, swear to me that you'll give me your birthright. And Esau says, fine, whatever, you can have it. What's that to me? I'm about to die anyways. And so he sells his birthright for a bowl of lentil soup, really. And so he gives it all up. And that's there in Genesis 25. I've already covered all this. All right. So now here we are in Genesis chapter 27. So, you know, we've covered their birth. We've covered this little situation where Esau gives up his birthright. And now we're here in Genesis chapter 27. Isaac's old, okay? Isaac's really aged. The Bible says that his vision was getting dim. I don't know if that means he was just all out blind or if he was partially blind. I don't know. What we do know is that he couldn't really make out who was who. What was that, Hank? Macular degeneration? And so he was going blind. He was close to dying. And he tells Esau, he says, look, go out and hunt for me and, you know, go find something. Bring me back one of those savory dishes of yours that I just love. Go do that. Prepare it for me. I'll eat it, and then I'll give you my blessing before I die. And so Esau takes off. Well, Rebecca overhears this conversation. She says, hey, Jacob, come here. Come here. Go get me two young goats and hurry up. And so she goes and she makes a dish of the young goats. She then takes the skin from the goats and she puts it on Jacob's hands and his arms and it says the smooth of his neck. And the idea is they're going to try to deceive Isaac here into thinking that he's Esau, and Jacob would then get the blessing. And so Jacob brings the dish in Genesis chapter 27. Jacob brings the dish to Isaac. Isaac hears Jacob's voice and says, you know, I hear the voice of Isaac, but I feel Esau. It's interesting, you know, you think of taking a goat skin and feeling how hairy that must be. Esau obviously was an unbelievably hairy man. I don't know, I think like werewolf hairy or something, you know. Incredibly hairy man. And so he says, this is Esau? And he says, yeah, Dad, this is Esau. Come here, my son, come closer. And so it says he kneels down, and Isaac smells of him and can smell the wild. You know, he has the goat skin on him. And so the goats have been out in the pen this whole time. They smell like the outside and a farm and stuff. And so Isaac says, well, it even smells like Esau. It must be Esau. And so he gives Jacob the blessing that's rightfully supposed to go to the firstborn. And he makes all these great blessings, pretty much grants him everything. Your brother's going to serve you and all this kind of stuff. And then we're told that as soon as Jacob left, it says Jacob had just barely left the presence of his father when Esau comes walking in. And Esau starts talking to Dad, and Isaac flipped out. Isaac says, who are you? Well, it's me, Esau. No, it's not. I was just talking to Esau. I just finished eating the meal you made for me, Dad. I just got back from it. I haven't even made the meal yet. And Isaac says, your brother's deceived you, but your brother has received your blessing. And Esau begins weeping and crying. Come on, Dad, certainly you have something left for me. And he says, son, I gave him everything. I gave him the world. I told him you were going to be his servant. He was supposed to be your servant, but now it's the other way around. And so we see this go down. But what we see here is that this happens just exactly the way God told Rebekah it would happen when she was pregnant with Jacob and Esau. She said, the older will serve the younger. And lo and behold, that's the way it came to be. So moving on, what's a lesson we can learn from this? Well, in Romans chapter 9, we see this really interesting passage. Romans 9 is an interesting chapter. It can be a challenging one. And so we read this here. It says, there was Rebekah also. This is Paul writing. There was Rebekah also when she had conceived twins by one man, our father Isaac. For though the twins were not yet born and had not done anything good or bad, so that God's purpose according to his choice would stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls, it was said to her, the older will serve the younger. Just as it is written, Jacob I loved, But Esau hated. I believe that's out of Malachi. Can somebody quote me on that? Is that out of Malachi? What shall we say then? There is no injustice with God, is there? May it never be. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. So then it does not depend on the man who wills or the man who runs, but on God who has mercy. So something we can learn from this is that God makes his choice and he goes with it, and that's that. There was nothing that that Esau or Jacob did that drove this. You know, Esau I have hated. Did God really hate Esau? No, of course not. You know, instead, though, the point of this passage is that neither Jacob nor Esau did anything good nor bad to receive what they did, because they weren't even born yet when God said it, this is the way it was going to be. Neither one had done anything to deserve a blessing or to be denied a blessing. None had done right, none had done wrong. This was all stated when they were in the womb, before they even breathed their first breath of life. It was simply God's choice. Now, you know, we can make an argument that, well, maybe God just in his infinite foreknowledge knew that Esau was going to be an immoral and godless guy. Maybe. You know, we can see over in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 16, it uses those exact words to kind of define Esau. And if you go on and read the story of Esau and what came from him, it sounds very similar to the line of Cain. All right? Very similar. And so, you know, we might be able to make that argument, but the bottom line, folks, is that neither Abraham nor Isaac did anything to deserve the blessings they did or they received. It was simply God's choosing. God said, I want Abraham, and that's what he went with. He told Rebecca, Jacob's going to be it, and that was it. And so we just need to take away from that and understanding that God has his will, God has his plan, and he's going to see that plan through one way or the other. All right, so Genesis 36 outlines Esau's lineage. It's full of wealth and kings and other leaders and national growth, yet it's void of a love for God and things that concern righteous living. And if my history is correct, so we see that Obadiah outlines the destruction that awaits Edom. Again, Edom is the line, the descendants of Esau. And by the end of the first century, Edom is barely in existence. Okay, and if you go read the book of Obadiah, he pretty much says, Edom, you're done. I'm done with you. I would assume A.D. has to be, yeah. Yeah, by the time Jesus showed up on the scene, Edom was kind of just done with. And so, you know, God said, enough is enough is enough. You're done. I'm going to make your place desolate and all. Yes. Yeah, we see a lot of conflict between those two for years. And, you know, that's kind of something we can take away from the Romans 9 passage too, right? Is it that may not necessarily have been a statement about the two individuals, Jacob and Esau, but of on the more the greater scene of Israel and Edom. Mike?
Does say, I mean, character says, see that there be no immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. Do you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, for he saw the world of fear.
Right.
There is a condemnation there for us.
Yeah, there is.
Bad choice.
Sure. Sure.
All right. Okay. So was Jacob an upstanding guy himself? Was he just this great guy who just... he wasn't, was he? I mean, man, he was a rather deceitful dude who took advantage of his own brother. Oh, you so hungry? You hungry, huh? Man, I got this bowl of soup here. You want to give me your birthright for it? you know... Well, not at the first. You know, the first one is when the second one, yeah. But the first one, you know, here's his brother obviously not doing too well, and he's like, man, I'm starving. Hey, can I, how bad you want it, you know? I mean, man, he's been a real jerk. And but then you also see how he even tried to take advantage of his own father. And something interesting there, if you go read that passage, when Rebekah hears about what's going on and kind of lays out, hey, Isaac, here's what we're going to do. I mean, Jacob, here's what we're going to do. And Jacob says, Mom, you know, Dad might realize that it's me and not Esau, and he might end up cursing me rather than blessing me. And Rebekah says, I'll let your curse be upon me. So it's interesting there. Here Isaac is plotting, I mean, Jacob, I keep getting mixed up. Here Jacob is plotting with his mom to deceive his own dad, and the only thing he's concerned about is getting caught. He's not concerned about just doing the right thing. You know, we don't see him saying, hey, Mom, this just isn't right. This is not what Dad taught me. You know, this is not right. Well, what if I get caught? You know, that's his concern. So even Jacob himself just doesn't seem to be this great guy that's ready to take on the helm of redemption, you know, from his dad. But who's that?
Jacob.
Jacob did? How so?
Well, when he left and he had to work for his father-in-law for his first wife.
Yeah.
Your father was a little deceived.
Yeah, a little, I think, is an understatement, brother. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, Jacob Flatt got a whopping from Laban. My word. Yeah.
There wasn't really good people in that group.
It wasn't. I mean, that's the thing, right? And that's the thing we need to. Well, that's the deal, you know. And that's what we need to take away from that is that we are all a bunch of mess up folks. Every last one of us, okay? And I have come to know you people very well over the past, what's it been, 2 years now, I think? I have come to know you brethren very well, and y'all are some outstanding, wonderful, God-fearing people. But you're still mess-ups.
We're still sinning.
I'm a mess-up, all right? Why in the world God would want to use me for something? You know, I'd kind of be like Moses saying, you might want to send somebody else. You know, not me, you know, but this is how God is, all right? God can take something and someone, and man, he can bring $1 million out of it, all right? You know, he can take a half a penny like me and make billions out of it. That's what God can do, and that's what we need to take away from these stories is we see these kind of people, and it's like, man, God was really struggling with his choices here, wasn't he? But boy, did it not all come to work out. And if you go read the line, the lineage of Jesus, man, there's all kinds of crazy people in there, prostitutes and all. But we still got Christ through them. We still got redemption through them. And so we ought not doubt God. We ought not doubt what he can do with each and every one of us. So bottom line, none of us deserve anything we have received. There is nothing, folks, I have ever done where I can shake my fist at God and say, you owe me. I just did this. I have no right to do that. I've done nothing to put him in debt to me. But everything I have is solely because he had the grace to give it to me. And folks, I'm telling you, we see the idea of grace over and over and over and over. You know, it's a big topic in the New Testament. We don't really see much talking about grace in the Old, but man, is it not there? I mean, straight out of the gate, Genesis 3:6, boom, there's grace. Right there in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created. Why? Because that's just what he chose to do for us. We didn't even exist yet he's sitting here making things for us. That's grace. Grace has been around since the first stroke of the pen in the Bible. And it's still very prevalent even to this very second. All right, in Genesis chapter 27, verse 46, Rebekah says to Isaac, I'm tired of living because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth like these from the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? Apparently Esau had married two Hittite women. And these being the daughters of Heth. And in Genesis 26:34, it tells us that these women brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. And so apparently it was just not a good situation. I don't know what kind of women they were. They were obviously some real troublesome women that were just absolutely bringing grief to these fine people, even to such a point where Rebekah says, look, if Jacob goes and finds wives like Esau did, I'm done. There's just not even a point in me continuing to live. Clearly, it was a pretty bad situation. And so what we see is, due to Rebekah's fears and Isaac's future wife, Abraham sends Jacob off to Rebekah's brother Laban to find a wife. And we'll finish up with this slide, and we'll pick up here next week. But so in Genesis chapter 28, 3 through 4, Isaac tells Jacob, may God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. May he also give you the blessing of Abraham to you and to your descendants with you, that you may possess the land of your sojournings, which God gave to Abraham. So we can already see that Isaac knows exactly what's going to happen next. You know, the promises were made to Abraham. Abraham passed them on to Isaac. Isaac has seen everything that's taken place with Jacob and Esau. He himself gave Isaac the blessing. And so Isaac just concludes naturally that, okay, well, Jacob's going to be the next in line to receive the promises, and the descendants, the promises that were made to my father, that were made to me, are now going to be passed on to him to carry on. So we'll drop it off there, and we'll continue zipping through this next week. Like I said, I'm just kind of giving a high-level fast-forward view of it all. I highly recommend you guys go and read these stories in Genesis, though. I mean, it's a fascinating read. It really is. And so take it for what you will. But anyhow, thank you for your time.